Mortgages should be illegal because you're getting robbed every month. With a typical $200,000 30-year mortgage, you'll end up paying over $400,000 after interest. Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My proven system can eliminate your mortgage and all your debts. Let me send you a powerful free CD. For your free CD, call 1-800-933-2911. 1-800-933-2911. 1-800-933-2911.
Blog Talk Radio.
Fiction and films. Now we'll go from the Saragossa manuscript in 1841 and on through Dion Fortune's Moon Magic, Somerset Maugham's The Magician, and that was a novel and a film. Chambers, The King in Yellow, that influenced Lovecraft, and Lovecraft's Dream Cycle. Abraham Merritt's Lost Worlds, they influenced Shaver. Jack Williamson's Darker Than You Think, and that happened to be Jack Parsons' favorite. Clark Ashton Smith, who I said was the dreammaker extraordinary, and a little bit about his imitator, Jack Vance, where we get the Dungeons and Dragons game from. And then some of the more recent fiction, Dallas by Philip K. Dick, and then we'll dip into magical films. We'll start with Cocteau's Orpheus back in 1949 and very shortly followed by Orson Welles' Black Magic, which was about Count Cagliostro, and Marion Cooper's version of She, and much later Simon King of the Witches in 1971. And then we'll, What Dreams May Come, that's a Swedenborgian kind of a thing. Then we'll talk about a little bit about the recent film Crowley, which we've already mentioned on an earlier show, and Alejandro Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain. So, this will be, as we said, a smorgasbord of mindbenders. Tune in and feast on it. Okay, the origin of this particular program goes back to 1999 in the seventh ray, the Blu-ray. And in that issue, I published in the book review section, I published a list of magical fiction, a little description of each. I left out some important ones, unfortunately, when I was able to correct tonight. What I said was that because we're an occasional journal, there was no necessity to be current or timely in book reviews. We can settle back and take a long view of any book category of books that bear on our magical art, recommending those long out of print. For nearly all can be obtained through a search service, especially on the internet or an interlibrary loan. Actually, you know, they're reprinting so many of these old classics now that you won't have any trouble finding anything that I mention here. It's just wonderful, and you can get them all through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And if you have trouble, if they can't find them for you, well, Libris can certainly find them for you. And keep in mind that High Magic is the active principle of romantic philosophy. Now, we'll explore the vast ocean of imaginative literature, which includes fantasy, horror, and science fiction. And we'll select a list of tales that offer more than just entertainment for the serious student of magic. Now, these novels and stories are not so much instructive as they are evocative. They subtly but nonetheless powerfully develop a magical state of mind. This includes the films, too. And I said, here are a few more than a baker's dozen of my personal favorites, and I'm sure there are deserving works that I have not included, and I know what they are, I'll mention them. But I am equally certain that the titles in this list deserve a place on the magician's bookshelf. Now, before we get into this, that's what we said in the seventh ray. But before we get into this, let me point something out. You're going to be probably surprised that I'm not going to mention a few of your favorites. And the reason why I'm not mentioning them isn't that I haven't come across them. It's because magic in fiction and in films is most often not presented the way it really is. It's most often presented as some preposterous kind of an art form that conjures things out of thin air that bite people and shower you with gold and all this sort of thing that magic really doesn't do. Well, it does, but it doesn't do it in the way that it does in most fantasy fiction, a lot of fantasy fiction, and of course in films. So these particular stories that I've selected are ones that present and evoke magic the way it really is, and yet they are very, very exciting and beautiful, and I think you'll like them. And these stories, by the way, have influenced magicians, and other magicians have also recommended them. The first one we start off with in this list, Lilith by George MacDonald, was one that Crowley recommended in The Equinox. Now, Lilith, this was George MacDonald was one of the Inkling crowd, that Tolkien and Lewis and that bunch, and he wrote Lilith back in the 1800s, late 1800s. Lilith is an incredible book. It's psychedelic. It's amazing. You read this and it's like somehow or other you wonder where he got the psilocybin. Anyway, it's an interplane symbolic adventure beyond death, psychedelic, nightmarish, eerie, and beautiful. It's a classic. That's Lilith by George MacDonald. My friend and mentor Lynn Carter edited one version of it in paperback. You probably could get that pretty easily. There are some trade paperbacks also available in a classic series. You won't have any trouble finding it. Now, the next one we'll talk about after that is The Magician by W. Somerset Maugham, who is, of course, one of the greatest novelists in the English language. And this was a very unusual thing for Maugham to write a book like this. It's very romantic. It's very very much of a melodrama, very much of a melodrama, which was unusual for Maugham. You know, he wrote things like The Razor's Edge that sort of thing. So this is a fictional demonization of Aleister Crowley with intimations of Frankenstein and Svengali. And it contains dark alchemical secrets. And, oh boy, it does. Now, what Maugham did, as any good novelist will do when he wrote this, after, you know, he knew Crowley, and he and Crowley were, I wouldn't call exactly friends, but they were acquaintances, they knew each other. So Maugham decided to do this, and he put himself into the British Museum. And he stayed in the British Museum, and according to his own description, he immersed himself in these old manuscripts in the British Museum. He dug up some stuff on alchemy that is absolutely fascinating. a little bit scary, too. So the Magician is one you really, really want to dig up and read. That's available in a new knockoff paperback version. And also, this was made into a film, a very beautiful, beautiful silent film, 1926, I think, by Rex Ingram, called The Magician. And the film is absolutely beautiful, and very, and you realize where Whaley got the idea for his Frankenstein sets and costumes and even his laboratory equipment. This is really, you need to see this film. I had an old, lousy old VHS print of it, and I loaned it to some of the guys, the OTO guys up in San Francisco, and I had to fight them to get it back. But now one of the cable channels, I guess TCM or they ran a beautiful, beautiful print. I'm trying to, however, I'm not sure that print is available on DVD yet, but it will be. That's one you need to see. Now, Moon Magic by Dionne Fortune, Violet First, and we can't forget this. This is, Moon Magic, I think, is her best book. She had several magical novels, The Sea Priestess and The Goatfoot God, various magical novels that she wrote. She was a late golden daughter, as you probably know. That's Violet First. And her boyfriend was a psychologist, who ran a private sanitarium, who became the character Dr. Taverner for her Dr. Taverner stories, which you should also look up. And Moon Magic is her kind of her story about herself as a priestess, and she leases an old ruined abbey and creates a temple, and just a beautiful at this stage. Dionne Fortune was a pagan. Later on, she went back to Christianity in her later life, but she was a full-blown pagan priestess when she wrote this one. This Moon Magic is when this is an insider's story. And, of course, as I said, The Secrets of Dr. Taverner is a collection of magical tales dealing with several aspects of practical occultism. And this is back in the 20s, you know, and this is back very, very golden dawnish, but it also has a psychological bent to it because Dr. Taverner himself, the real Dr. Taverner, was a psychotherapist and a doctor, and so there is this psychological approach to magic, which takes it above and beyond the Hollywood level. Now, next, I have The Great God Pan, which is a novella, a short novel, by Arthur Machen. Now, this is a haunting story that rends the veil separating inner and outer worlds. It was a major influence on Howard Phillips Lovecraft. It's a classic. And so The Great God Pan is one of these stories that influenced our beloved H.P. Lovecraft. And that brings us to H.P. Lovecraft. Now, everybody likes to read the horror stories, the Cthulhu mythos and all that. But really, when you get down to it, Lovecraft's fantasies, his influence by Lord Dunsany, and frankly, I think, I have all of Dunsany's material and it's good and all of that, but Lovecraft was a better stylist. He was a much better stylist than Dunsany. And the dream cycle, the dream cycle stories of Lovecraft are incredibly magical. And this Through the Gates of the Silver Key, which was written in collaboration with E. Hoffman Price, who was something of an occultist, this contains a very valuable exposition of interdimensional theory, which I think you'll find interesting. It's called Through the Gates of the Silver Key. Now, I'd also like to mention one other thing by Lovecraft, which is his venture into traditional old black magic and alchemy, and that's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Now, that also has been made into a film a couple times. The best film version of this is The Haunted Palace with Vincent Price And Vincent Price and Lon Chaney did this one, and they just beautiful. It's Roger Corman, by the way, and it's very, very, very flavorful, and you can get that on DVD. And now let's move on to The Ship of Ishtar by Abraham Merritt. Now, Abraham Merritt is due for a revival. I expect to see in the Science Fiction Book Club, I expect to see the start of an Abraham Merritt revival. It's building up. Abraham Merritt was one of the greatest fantasy writers who ever lived. This man was a really good professional journalist, and he was the editor, well, for several years, he was the editor of the American Weekly, which was one of the big nationwide Sunday supplement magazines. It was in, I would say, more than half the papers in the United States. And Abraham Merritt was the editor. Now, Abraham Merritt wrote his fantasies he didn't write them for the pot like some of these pulp magazine writers that were banging away on their typewriters, you know, to feed themselves. Merritt did this because he enjoyed it. And his stories, Abraham Merritt's Lost World stories, are just, they're scintillating, they're beautiful. His vocabulary was marvelous, he painted pictures with words of scintillating light and shimmering, shining visions that just... reading a Merritt story is like a dream. Once you actually get through with the Indiana Jones part of it and actually enter the Lost World, you can't remember if somebody asked you to tell them the story. After you've read it, 2 weeks after you've read it, you can say, well, we went to Mongolia, and then we had this expedition, and we got that, and we went into this, through this thing, and God, I don't remember what happened after that, but then we came back. Because it's like Chinese food after it's so beautiful, it's so dreamlike that you have difficulty remembering it. While you're reading it, you're just in a trance. So Abraham Merritt, The Ship of Ishtar, by the way, is the most magical of his stories because this is a ship, a little model, beautifully carved, ancient model ship that's black on the stern side and white on the bow, and the priestess of Ishtar is in the forecastle, and the priest of Nergal is in the stern castle. And the two of them are cursed because of a sex magic operation they did 4,000 years ago. They're cursed to sail on this astral sea in this model ship and have this symbolic magical battle for the rest of eternity. And, of course, the young archaeologist becomes
intoxicated with the model and finds that he falls into it and
joins them. And this you can imagine just how wonderful this thing is. So after that, we want to mention Dwellers in the Mirage by Abraham Merritt. This is a modern man possessed by his ancestral incarnation. This one takes place in Mongolia, and it deals with the deepest mysteries of Mongolia, which we're just now beginning to really unravel. And I
won't spoil it for you by telling you that much about it, but it's one of these
stories that you'll know as you read it. There's some deep dark ancient secrets in it. Now, moving right along to Clark Ashton Smith. Now,
Lauren just picked up on the Clark Ashton Smith sculpture, and we were looking at it on the web. Whose website is that? On the Clark Ashton Smith. Anyway, he was a sculptor and poet, and he was one of the most marvelous, limpid, erudite
fantasy stylists that the world has ever produced. This man wrote prose, magical prose, that was incredible. And he created these fantasy worlds, somewhat theosophic, ancient, very, very ancient worlds. He and Lovecraft were close friends and close correspondents. Neither one of them imitated the other. They were both masters in their own right. But Clark Ashton Smith, his ancient worlds and the magical tales that he spins, these are just incredibly beautiful. And so the Out of Space and Time, and Genus Loci, Lost Worlds. I'm mentioning a few titles here. So Clark Ashton Smith is one that you really, really need to have. You at least need to have one really good Clark Ashton Smith book to feast on. And after that, the complete John Silent Stories by Algernon Blackwood. Blackwood was one of the Golden Dawn people, and these are the strange cases of a consulting psychic delivered by a master storyteller, and it contains the horror classic Ancient Sorceries of the Cat People. That's where Cat People comes from. Clark, Algernon Blackwood is a very subtle and a very mature adult kind of style, and you'll enjoy him. Now we mentioned The King in Yellow by Robert W. Chambers. The King in Yellow, if you're a Lovecraft fan, you will have probably run across various articles that people write about Lovecraft and what influenced him. Lovecraft was influenced by a number of earlier writers. Arthur Menken, of course, was one. Edgar Allan Poe, of course, was one. But The King in Yellow by Robert Chambers, who was primarily a regular mainstream novelist. Chambers didn't write too much fantasy. Have I got a call? Chambers didn't write too much fantasy, but when he did, the few that he did certainly were memorable. Now, The King in Yellow is a collection of stories about the effect of a mysterious book that drives its readers insane. Now, you can imagine why this was an influence on Lovecraft, because The King in Yellow is probably where Lovecraft got the idea for the Necronomicon. The King in Yellow, the book that Chambers is referring to, was actually a play, and it was published in a little private edition, and people who would read this book, everybody that got it and everybody that read it, either went insane, committed suicide, committed horrible murders, or ended up in some awful way, and to the point where the book became very, very difficult to obtain. But, of course, then, obviously, more and more people were trying to find it. And the thing that is so really scary about the first story in The King in Yellow, The Repairer of Reputations. The thing that's so scary about this is that Chambers was able, in this story, as you follow the protagonist through the story from his point of view, he very subtly and slowly goes crazy. And you don't realize this fully until the later part of the story, but the way he handles it, you're right in there, and the effect is actually almost like reading The King in Yellow itself. So this is one that you might want to look up. Chambers' work's been republished too. Now we'll move on. Yeah, and actually we're moving backward in time a little bit here. The Saragossa Manuscript, or The Manuscript Found in Saragossa, which is the proper title of it, by Jan Potocki. Now, this is a surrealistic Decameron-style excursion through a haunted region of Spain, and it's now recognized now as a classic of literature. Now, the Saragossa Manuscript was first published in 1841. It was written back earlier. Jan Potocki was one of these
one of these protean geniuses, an adventurer. He was a Freemason. He was a Rosicrucian. He was a Kabbalistic student. He was, and he also, he went to Mongolia at one point, and that, and he had a very active sex life, and he kind of enjoyed a series of menage a trois, and he finally, and this probably has something to do with his trip to Mongolia, finally, after writing this marvelous occult, mysterious occult Saragossa manuscript, he blew his brains out with a church-blessed silver bullet. So you wonder what he found out in Mongolia, or what bit him in Mongolia. Anyway, the Saragossa manuscript is just indescribably good. It's in the Cameron style, stories within stories within stories within stories, and it's about this secret underground magical Muslim cavern empire in southern Spain, where the Muslims have been driven underground, and they have a treasure, and the Kabbalist has a castle, and they have a couple of vampires, and everybody that somehow or other has a vision ends up waking up under the two corpses of the two vampire brothers. This is a marvelous thing, and it has mirror magic in it. I cut my teeth on this Saragossa manuscript. I think it's one of the things that influenced me on my mirror magic, because there's a lot of use of mirrors magical mirrors in the Saragossa manuscript. I strongly recommend that. By the way, we are running in the coming seventh ray. We're going to be running a couple of a pastiche of two of the Kabbalistic stories from the Saragossa manuscript. Now, after that, I mentioned, I'm going to skip down this list because I got it out of. I want to kind of keep it in some kind of time sequence here. My first 2,000 years, the autobiography of the Wandering Jew, by George S. Myrick and Paul Eldridge. Now this may be a little difficult to find these days. It's a fascinating historical novel about immortals influencing history. This is Calcrates and Salome, the two immortals, and how they go all through history. And the story proceeds on several levels. It's a controversial classic. I think that you really enjoy this one. But one of the things that's very illuminating and interesting about this is that this was written by George Sylvester Myrick. And those of you who are deep into the history of Crowley and all of his doings, you will realize that George Sylvester Myrick was the same German who hired Crowley during World War I in New York to write propaganda for the Germans. And Crowley, in his confessions, said that he, it was easy to put this ridiculous propaganda that he was writing to get George to accept it, because George was an umpapa stupid German, and he didn't realize that Crowley was actually doing a disservice to the Germans with this stuff that he was writing. Well, now, when you read the first 2,000 years, the autobiography of the Wandering Jew, you're going to realize that George Sylvester Myrick was no stupid umpapa German. And so that casts some serious doubt on Crowley's statement there about his what he was doing in World War I. However, regardless of that, my first 2,000 years is one that I think you'll really like. Now, the next one we want to talk about is Darker Than You Think, by Jack Williamson. Now, this is a science fiction horror story about genetic throwbacks who become astral werewolves. Come from Mongolia, by the way. Remarkably close to actual shamanic techniques.
This was the favorite novel of rocket scientist and magician Jack Parsons. Let me say a few things about this. This is probably one of the most effective and one of the most genuinely frightening werewolf novels you will ever read. And the reason is because these werewolves are very possibly real. I'm beginning to look more and more like the werewolf tradition really starts in Mongolia, and it starts back in Paleolithic times. And according to, and this story came out, by the way, in 1941, so he was really ahead of his time as far as his anthropology is concerned. But the basic premise of the story is that, yes, they are, it is a bloodline. Yes, they are a different species, Homo lycanthropus, but they don't do physical transformations. They go after you on the astral. And they cause you to have accidents and heart attacks and things like this. And they go and they assume animal form on the astral, and then they go after their victims. Now, this is very shamanic, very Mongolian, and it also was translated into Buddhism in the form of Trongjug Yoga. So we're looking here at something that's just like, this is, you might say, the real thing. And the story is gripping and very suspenseful, and it had an influence on a film some of you may have seen called Angel Heart. Angel Heart, although it didn't deal with werewolves, Angel Heart uses the same plot. From as darker than you think. I don't want to spoil the story for you by giving you a spoiler on it, but it's one that, as I said, Jack Parsons really. Now, Jack Williamson was badgered by nascent witches in LASVAS, the Los Angeles Science Fiction Club, who would come up to him when he'd come to the club, and they'd say, you know secrets, don't you? You know, where did you get the lore for this thing? Where did you find out? And Williamson just brushed him off and said, oh, come on, it's just a story. It's just a story. Forget it. But this is one that, as I say, if you're into this sort of thing, from an occult point of view, you really ought to read this one. Now, you may mention What Dreams May Come by Richard Matheson. Of course, he also wrote I Am Legend. Now, this was recently made into a major motion picture with Robin Williams. It's a moving and very personal modern version of Dante's Divine Comedy. Now, it's also, and I think we should mention this about What Dreams May Come, it's also very Swedenborgian. And I think that, if you want to really... If you want to get a quick and easy dose of Swedenborg, Swedenborg otherwise is, oh, God, he's boring. I said one time that you could reduce the size of Swedenborg's books by two-thirds if you took out every word good that he has in his books. If you took all the goods out, you would reduce the books down to about a little less than a half of what their size would be. And Blake, of course, was a great Swedenborgian, and Blake finally rebelled against him. But What Dreams May Come is very much worthwhile to give you a good dose of Swedenborg, a painless dose of Swedenborg. Now, let me talk about a couple more recent ones. Before we get on to the recent ones, the one that I forgot to put in this list back in 1999, and I've been wondering ever since why I forgot it. I don't know why that would ever possess me to forget it, because it's one of the most magical novels ever written, and it was written back in the 20s. And when it came out, it was supposed to be shocking, and they were banning it in Boston and everything else. And that's Jurgen by James Branch Cabell. And this is absolutely outstanding. It's symbolic. It's
It's beautiful. It even has, and you fellow mites will love this, it's got a whole chapter on the Gnostic Mass in this novel, this fantasy novel. And Jurgen goes through this thing with the priestess. And Crowley and Campbell, Crowley just loved it. He recommended it highly because he knew that Campbell had used his Gnostic Mass in the book. So Jurgen is one of these things. It's difficult to describe. It's very symbolic. Campbell has a marvelous sense of humor. He takes Jurgen, hell's a democracy, and heaven is exactly the way your fundamentalist grandmother thought it was. And oh, this is it's more fun than what dreams may come. Let me put it that way. But it is very, 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 very worth reading. And I think Jurgen is just one of these treasures. You just got to read Jurgen. And I don't know why. I could kick myself for not putting it in back in 99. I should have. What happened there? But now, moving into more recent fiction. There's one more I forgot, too, and I didn't put it in there. Zanoni by Bulwer Lytton. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not wild about Zanoni, but it is a very... It's another one of these things that was back in the 1880s, and it's very occult and Rosicrucian, and has the concept of the dweller on the threshold, and it's very much of an occult morality play. Bulwer Lytton wrote a couple of other occult novels. He was a politician, by the way, and a highly respected British politician and civil servant. One of them that he did, Thrill, The Power of the Coming Race. And this was a Shaver, like probably influenced Shaver. It was about an underground race of super beings that were going to come up and take over the earth when they finally got their stuff together to do it. And they had this secret power, this power source called Vril, which did just about everything. And the Germans liked this so much, the pre-Nazis and maybe a few of the post-Nazis, they liked this so much they made a cult out of it, the Vril Society. So that was Vril. Zanoni is another one. And so Bulwer Lytton, of course, you all have heard, I'm sure, of the annual Bulwer Lytton Worst First Sentence for a novel. They have an annual contest. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek literary contest to write the worst first sentence of a novel. And you get the one that writes the worst first sentence gets a prize. And a few years ago, some lady got a prize for one that went something like, Sister Agatha stared up from flat on her back on the mat as the 300-pound nude lesbian sumo wrestler descended on her, and she was forced to admit that the Pope had betrayed her, and that she won the worst first sentence contest with that one. Anyway, that was the Bulwer Lytton contest. But Bulwer Lytton, Thrill's pretty easy reading. I took it up to Mount Shasta with me, and I was reading it while I was up there. Good place to read it. Now, let's talk about a new one, one more recent one. Valis by Philip K. Dick. Okay. Now, Dick was just as crazy as Richard Shaver. Crazy perhaps in a different way. No, actually, maybe in the same way. I don't know. But Valis is a very, very uncomfortable book because what Dick does in Valis is he takes you through he takes you through his own madness. And his own madness and his religious experience in Valis. But then, when he gets through this and he starts having his vision, the awesome import of this and what makes Valis almost, for those of you who are really, really into modern alchemy and modern atomic, you know, quantum physics and all this, if you're really up on this sort of thing, this Valis is incredible, because Dick's translation of his name from Greek in Horse Lover Fat, that's right. Horse Lover Fat, who's the character, fully realizes in the end of this book that God is information. That's what God is. God is information. God is binary. God is, God, this is God. God's information. And this, Dick came out with this several years before quantum physics got around to actually postulating the same thing. And this makes Valis an incredibly prophetic and quite an experience. It really is. Valis is one that I think that is really a mind expanding literary experience. I think you really really get a kick out of it. Now, let's talk about some films. We already mentioned the silent film Rex Ingram's 1926, The Magician. If you can find it, especially if you find this new print, that's absolutely beautiful. Now, Orpheus by Jean Cocteau. Orpheus was done with one cheap old movie camera in post-war France, 1947, 1948. They did this, shot this thing black and white. At least it was sound. With one old movie camera, and did their special effects all by themselves. But this film is absolutely incredible. It's Orpheus in modern dress. It's the Orpheus legend in modern dress. But the thing that is so great about it, and I saw this back when I was a kid in sophomore in college, and this thing blew me away. Because what it shows you and what you realize as you watch this film is that this world that we live in is magical. You don't have to go to a fantasy world. Cocteau makes the world around you magical, and the people around you magical. And the people, they're not really people, they're Greek gods. But they're just ordinary, they act like and look like ordinary people. And the Death, Lady Death, rides around in a Rolls Royce with a radio. And the radio broadcasts from the underworld. And it broadcasts cryptic messages from the underworld. And Orpheus, the poet, is fascinated by what comes across the radio in Death's Rolls Royce. And he hears things like, "To the poet, to the bird who speaks with his fingers," and things like this, these strange messages coming across, and then when they pass through the mirrors, and here again we're using mirrors again, they pass through the mirrors, this special effect, they turn the camera sideways, and then they put their hands into a trough of mercury in the mirror and made it look like they were pushing their hands through the mirror with gloves on, of course. But it was beautifully done. And then they take the camera and put it up on a ladder and then shoot them down from top, going through the mirror and into the other world. And this film, it's very inexpensive, and it's And yet it has that magical flavor to it that just gives you the idea that the world itself is magical. And so Orpheus is a real classic. They still show it today. They still show it on the classic channels on TV, and it's a wonderful film. You can get it on DVD, of course. Now, following that, Black Magic, Orson Welles, the great Orson Welles. And in Black Magic, Orson Welles plays Count Cagliostro. And he does a wonderful job playing Count Cagliostro. This is back in the, you know, right before the French Revolution. It's a black and white film, but it's very, very well produced and very, very well mounted. And he does his magic with hypnosis. This is the whole Cagliostro's power is hypnosis. He learns it from Anton Mesmer. And then the two in the end, they have this duel, this hypnotic duel in the courtroom. And this is where I think probably I got the idea in my head that magic is really hypnosis. You know, this is, it, and it's, so I, and it's a very good film, and I strongly recommend it. Some more recent films, though, that we need to mention, and one of them, of course, is Marion Cooper's version of She, of Rider Haggard's She. Now, Rider Haggard, let me point something out about Rider Haggard's She. It was came out back in 1897, I think. And the first version of She, the novel, she was the immortal woman. You know, Aisha, she who must be obeyed. And she lived in the secret surviving ancient Egyptian kingdom of Kor, lost in the Libyan desert. And she lived for thousands of years waiting for her lover to return in another incarnation. And she kept herself alive. Well, they hadn't discovered radium at that point. So in the original she was using some sort of chemical transformation. But then after radium was discovered in 1904, well, about the turn of the century, actually, and then by 1904, Rider Haggard did another version of She called The Return of She, the second version. And that time, he put the radiation in. Now, when Rose Sciozzak, who was the screenwriter for Cooper's version of She, 1935, he did that after King Kong, by the way. Rose took Return of She and the radium idea, and she used that, which of course is at that time was the big thing with alchemy at that time, and so in the film version, which is a wonderful film, by the way. Recently, Ray Harryhausen has done a color version. And this film should have been shot in color in the first place. This film had a tremendous influence on Schaefer, I'm sure. This film should have been shot in color. Ray Harryhausen did a beautiful job of colorizing it. So if you're going to get the film, for heaven's sake, get the colorized version. And in this, the alchemy in the film version of She is based upon the second She book, and it goes right along with the study of alchemy at that time. So this is one to see very definitely. Now, we move on to one of my particular favorites, and that's Simon, King of the Witches, and that's 1971. Very low-budget film. Low-budget, and the plot of Simon, King of the Witches is he's this Hollywood witch who lives in a storm drain, You know, he's not a witch. He's a magician, but he lives in the storm drain, and he rises to occult power, and finally does terrible things. But Simon uses the guy, this Tiffany, who wrote the screenplay, claimed that he was an occultist himself. I mean, he certainly did his homework because he's read enough Crowley and enough Barden to put together some very interesting magical scenes and sex magic and charging an effluvial condenser, if you will. And Simon King of the Witches is one to look at because it shows magic pretty much the way we do it. And it is kind of an insider's thing. Now, according to urban legend, I was supposed to have been the model for Simon myself, but I'm not sure about that because I never lived in a storm drain and I didn't you know kill anybody and at least nobody I know about and I don't know, but I did ride around on a motorcycle with smoked cigars and carried a bottle of wine in a paper sack, so I suppose maybe I might have been, I don't know. The other one I think we'll mention too, while we're in line with magical films here, is Alejandro Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain. Now, Alejandro Jodorowsky is a fascinating character, an occultist, a tarot master, by the way. Has a book out now on tarot. He's in his 90s. He's hale and hearty over in France teaching tarot and whatever. But he was an underground filmmaker back in the 70s. He did a thing called El Topo, which became sort of the father of the midnight movies. The Holy Mountain, however, is his more magical, mystical film, hermetic film. And it's very unique. And what it deals with is a young man who goes through kind of a Christ-like figure, and he goes through a whole bunch of symbolic initiations, and then finally, he and this group of symbolic people, each of which represent a planet, and each of which have a particular important career, they all give up all of their worldly possessions and seek to climb the Holy Mountain. And they go on this quest to climb, to find the Holy Mountain and climb it. Now, quite frankly, I hadn't seen this film, until we were two-thirds of the way through Beyond Lemuria before I ever even saw this film, but there is some similarity. I mean, you can compare the two films. Jodorowsky had a different approach to the Holy Mountain than we did, but the films are similar. But Jodorowsky's, some of the symbolism and the visuals and the hermetic symbolism, very evocative, and his tarot symbolism is very interesting, and the idea of the quest of these people that represent the different planets up the mountain is something that you really ought to look at. By the way, if somebody wants to call in, we have a few minutes left. If you want to call in, the call in number is 347-857-1830. So if you want to get a quick one in, you can go ahead and call us in. And next week. Next week, we'll try to have some more call-ins. I'll mention a couple of more modern films. I think I will mention, just quickly in passing, Dark City. Now, that is a very magical film and about the power of the human imagination and the idea that you are the center of the universe. Dark City, that's one you might want to look at. And this most recent one, Inception. Inception is remarkable. I mean, I couldn't believe that Hollywood would actually make a major film like Inception. It's about controlling your dreams and going into other people's dreams. You know, Michael Moorcock wrote a couple of books on the dream thief. Well, that's what that's what goes on in Inception, is the invasion of other people's dreams. And this is one that very thought-provoking, and you might want to take a look at. Now, next week, we're going to have another fascinating topic, which is somewhat similar to what we've been discussing tonight. Oh, by the way, before we wrap this up, Kenneth Grant, by the way, is very, very much influenced by magical fiction. Lovecraft and Sax Rohmer. Sax Rohmer, the Fu Manchu, the guy who wrote Fu Manchu, had quite an influence on Kenneth Grant. So, I think that, and Crowley, of course, loved Lilith, and these books that we've been discussing tonight, these books have had an influence on a number of magicians, and they are very definitely worth reading. Now, next week, we're going to deal with the Enoch syndrome. This is going to be controversial. It's going to be very interesting. We'll talk about and explore these revelations that have popped up every so often, these tremendously complex and marvelously worked out revelations. And we'll do the Book of Mormon, of course. We'll briefly discuss that. And, of course, the Book of Enoch is the first one. The Book of Enoch, the Book of Mormon. We'll discuss Dean Kelly a little bit. And the Awasfi Bible that came out back in the late 1800s. And then one of the ones we used Beyond Lemuria, that's Dweller on Two Planets, the story of Philos. The Urantia book, you've heard of that one. And, of course, the Shaver Mystery. And then we're going to deal with the psychological end of this, The Jet-Propelled Couch by the psychiatrist Lodner, which details a psychiatric review of a person who is affected, a professional atomic scientist who is affected by the Enoch syndrome and becomes a galactic emperor every night. And that became the inspiration for a recent film called K-Pax. So we're going to deal with a fascinating subject of the Enoch syndrome and the visions that result from this particular phenomenon. And it really is. It's had a lot of influence on people and on the world, and it is a remarkable phenomenon, and we're going to get into it in some depth next week. And also, we'll take some call-ins next week. Now, just to kind of recap what we were talking about tonight, these fictional books and films are not the usual Hollywood version of films. One thing I mentioned, I think that Jack Vance was the writer of a series of fantasies called Dying Earth that were influenced by Clark Ashton Smith. And Dying Earth are beautiful fantasies, but that's where Dungeons and Dragons comes from. And the fellow that invented Dungeons and Dragons admitted that before he died. So if you want to read stories that are magical the way the Dungeons and Dragons people want it to be, which is kind of Hollywoodish, then read Jack Vance's The Dying Earth. They're beautiful stories too, by the way. But then you compare those to the kind of magic in these other stories, and you'll see there is a difference. And it looks like we're just about out of time, so I hope I've stimulated you a bit and given you some titles to look for on Amazon and on Barnes & Noble and maybe even Alibris, and get you to reading some of the oldies and the goodies. And we'll see you next week. And meanwhile, Good magic.